Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the October 4, 2021 County Commissioners Meeting. We are reconvening for September 7th. Okay. For this meeting, Chair Lee is not here today. She is out of town. And I will ask Mr. Robinson, Commissioner Robinson, would he lead us in
invocation and pledge allegiance, please?
My Lord, my Jesus, we thank you for yesterday, the past, and we don't thank you in advance for the future. The future we need to bring the county, the state, and the country all back together. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Welcome, Commissioner.
First thing we have on our agenda is approval of meeting minutes for January 20, 2021 and work session January 20, 2021. Closed session.
Motion. Vice Chair, move to approve both, please.
Okay. And I'm second.
Second.
Okay. We have a proper motion second. All in favor?
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Next one is approval of contract for aging services provided through the Older American Act and state appropriated funds from the North Carolina Division of Aging. Yeah, a motion.
So move. We accept the motion.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. We have a proper first and a second. All in favor?
Uh-huh.
Aye. Next one, approval of senior center general purpose funding. Everybody read that? Looked at it?
Yes.
Have a motion, please.
Move to approve.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Second. Okay. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Next one, approval of budget amendment number 21-07. Has everybody had a chance to look at that?
Yes, so move.
Okay, we have a first. I have a second, please.
A second.
Thank you. Mr. Atkins, we have a proper first and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Approval of OSHA COVID-19 emergency temporary standard. So, a little bit of discussion on that.
Yes, Commissioner, Vice Chair Trent, HR Director, Risk Management Director Courtney Ward is here to give you an update on that.
Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
The Department of Labor has implemented an emergency temporary standard for healthcare settings across North Carolina. It has required employers with more than 10 employees to adopt a COVID-19 plan for their healthcare settings. Included in your packet, you'll find a policy that I am proposing for approval that will specifically cover only Bertie County Emergency Medical Service and all of the locations that require emergency response where care is given beyond first aid. As we identify EMS as our medical staff and the locations that they are called to render care are the healthcare settings. This is a short overview. This COVID-19 plan includes safety protocol standards, including appropriate PPE, adequate record keeping, hazard assessment and prevention, removal from the workplace for COVID-19 related reasons, and which is coupled with salary continuation for those individuals, physical distancing, vaccination incentive, and so on. The majority of the practices and the safety within the safety protocols, according to the regulations, has already been standard practice for Bertie County EMS. This policy simply turns what we already have in place for the most part into a written policy required by OSHA.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions?
I only have one question. Ms. Ward, so what happens if an employee violates this policy? What repercussions are there? Could there be? Does the county become liable? the employee liable if they knowingly or unknowingly did something?
The regulation is more so directed at the employer. It's to make sure all of these standards and procedures are in place as far as providing the proper PPE, the record keeping part, requiring the social distancing, the removal from the workplace, all of those things. It's making sure that we are on top of our safety measures within the healthcare settings.
But it doesn't eliminate if an employee was somehow infected and wanted to some reason fault the county as part of that or not having appropriate things in place. Does that come into play at all or not really?
Not really. As far as the policy is written in the guidance that OSHA provides, it just goes over what we are responsible for implementing for our employees. So I would say that if we stay on top of what we're supposed to be implementing, and I don't think we would have anything to worry about as far as any situation like that coming up. And I would have to say EMS really does a great job at staying on top of their safety protocols.
So OSHA requires it, and now we have it in place. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So we'll be up to the EMS director to be keeping up with us. Is that how it's going to work?
Well, technically, Courtney here will be our
liaison,
the COVID safety coordinator, but she will be working closely with Mitch and Victoria to make sure that these things are in place and take care of.
Mr. Attorney, just a question. We're speaking about liability and OSHA setting some standards up here. What kind of liabilities have we heard anything out in the private sector as far as private sector? Because it would affect us as far as liability from somebody connecting or getting COVID from job sites. And of course, we have job sites here. So have we heard anything where somebody has filed suit or anything of that nature? Or was there something that was passed that would protect, because I know it was in conversation to protect employers of liability situations with COVID?
No, sir. I haven't heard of any specific suits. I think one of the main reasons that we haven't heard much in that arena is that there, for a suit to be successful, you got to prove causation. And proving that the cause of your COVID infection was a particular job site or area is really difficult. I just don't think anybody's been ready to try to jump that hurdle. So I haven't really seen anything that would be of a case that would be enough concern that I would bring to your attention.
Yeah, so these policies are being set up by OSHA coming to us and, of course, to other people. They're going to be checking, and any violations we have on that, that could sort of set up a liability issue for us, and that could be the next cause for somebody to file suit because we weren't following the mandates from OSHA. Is that correct, Steve?
Right. If you stick with the policy and follow your policy, you're for liability purposes, you're pretty good.
Okay, thanks.
What are the time limitations on this plan?
As far as how long do we have to
have it take effect? When does it end?
It's actually retroactive to June, and it's open indefinitely until OSHA says that ETS standard is no longer required. It's no longer necessary, and I would assume it will be through the duration of the pandemic. But I would also like to add, as far as employees contracting of the virus in the workplace, we do have workers' comp that will cover as long as like Jonathan mentioned, we are able to prove that they caught COVID-19 while on duty. Workers' comp will pick up that claim, which will cover any time loss, of course, that is included in the ETS. But for some reason, we do not continue the salary. Workers' comp will, as well as covering medical expenses.
Well, let me get back to that, because county manager and I just had a discussion about that about 10 minutes ago, and another branch of
government on issues that term. They're saying they caught it from another employee.
Now, I have asked that question to our workers' comp company specifically, and their employee, while they are not performing their duties, they will not cover it. So,
but if they are in the same building with them and they catch it from an employee and they're both working, would that be the active duties?
I do not think our insurance will cover that situation. I think if it was in a healthcare setting, they would. but just office setting. Just, and I think it's because it's a lower risk setting.
Mm-hmm.
Office setting. That's pretty much all we have other than EMS and first response. So yeah, as far as our discussion, my discussion with the workers' comp company, they're only looking to cover healthcare employees because they are so high risk.
And OSHA is covering all employees correctly.
Well, the emergency policies? Temporary standard is for healthcare employees and healthcare setting.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody have any other questions?
Healthcare employees. I mean, is that very narrow term? Was it would people like in social services be considered quote health care?
They would have to have health care certification or license. So it would, it's very specific to
people who are licensed.
Yes.
Gotcha. And if I can just step on that real quick. But they also have people at DSS that are going to visit places that they could pick COVID up from.
Agree.
Will that then be workers' comp?
I can ask our workers' comp company that question, but they are, that one would be, I'm not certain off the top of my head, because I do agree that that would be putting our employee in a high-risk situation. I think they're targeting possible direct healthcare, direct contact, hands-on contact with a COVID-19 positive individual.
Okay, but getting away from the direct contact versus medical, mm-hmm. County manager, it may be
something wise for us to make contact with workers' comp, with departments that we have, mm-hmm. and say if they come in contact, for example, DSS, going outside of their office realm and going to make that visit or going
to inspect
a daycare, things of that nature, are they covered? And I think that's an important conversation we have with workers' comp, because it's not only just medical. I think it's going to wrap up and come on down to these different departments, and especially with OSHA coming through, even though they're specifying medical, like you said a second ago. Mm-hmm. Okay? I think this is something that we need to go ahead and touch base on and get it wrapped up and have an idea, so that if it does happen and they come back to us, we don't have a statement. Not that
we would make it, of course, but
somebody said, I really don't know. So we could put that on the list of things to do. Not that you haven't got enough already.
Yes, I forgot it.
Get that part, but I just think we can do it.
Okay.
Anything else?
Ventilation. Are we already... are we complying with all these ventilation regulations? And if not, how far away are we? This seems a little elaborate to me. And if you just read the very last paragraph there under ventilation, it seems, I don't know how far are we from that.
So the very last one, it's in airborne infection isolation rooms.
Ventilation policies and procedures will be implemented along with other provisions required by OSHA COVID-19 ETAs as part of the multi-layering infection control approach. Berkeley County government will identify a building manager, HVAC professional, or maintenance staff member who can certify that the HVAC systems are operating in accordance with ventilation provisions for OSHA.
Can I address that, county manager?
Yes, sir. And okay. So that person, that building manager, has been identified as our maintenance director, who's Anthony Rasko. And I do believe for the most part we are, but I will absolutely double check and make sure for each item that we are in compliance with what's stated here.
One thing I'd like to add to that, very good point, Commissioner Atkins, is that the Bertie Martin Regional Jail put in a filtration system through their HVAC, okay? Bertie Martin Correctional Facility has been one of the only facilities that I know of that has had zero cases of COVID reference inmates once we put this system in. That building is approximately 22,000 square feet. I'm not sure what the square footage of this building is, but I would think it would be somewhere close comparable. Maybe an idea, a thought process, because I will say this, when we were doing a lot of work and getting ducts cleaned and things of that nature that had been not done over a 30-year period, okay, and getting ductwork that was rehung and things of that nature and getting rid of other issues that were in the attic and crawl spaces, not only in the courthouse, but here also, is that we have an open air system, which means open air has filters that are sitting in the open. It the return heirs in a room type situation. I think the board in itself needs to look at the same type of HVAC vent system that was installed at the jail. It's something to look at. County manager and has been known about this since March 18th or 17th is when we put it in over at the jail. It's proven out, self-cleaning, eradicates the viruses, had not been proved on COVID, but I think in itself, I think you would have to say it's proved itself now since we have gone with no cases of COVID. And we've also have had people that were arrested by the sheriff's department that had felony murder warrants that did test positive for COVID and then had to be brought into the jail and put into the isolation room like we typically do, but it's all vented the same way. It may be something that we would want to look at in case we have an issue with that. I think that cost us somewhere around $15,000, $17,000 to have that system put in. And it's a self-cleaning and eradicates everything from TB, influenza, ammonia, pneumonia virus, bacterial pneumonia, H1N1, everything. It just hadn't been tested on COVID, but I think it would be fairly safe to say it has been tested now, okay?
I would think that would probably make a lot of sense. The only, when you read the six bullets that are here under ventilation, the only one that gives me any kind of pause, because the first five is simply maintenance, basic maintenance requirements. The last one, though, is I don't know if we have an isolation room, do we? Do we have an isolation room in the county facility? Because that's the only one where it says specific maintenance requirements by design and construction must be in effect. Everything else is just simple cleaning, maintenance, you know.
Right, and it says if any, so.
Right, you know, so I don't know if we do have any, do we? So the other ones, if you read them, it's just simple maintenance issues.
To Commissioner's point, anyway. Commissioner Weston's point, I think that management needs to look at that
heating and air room,
okay,
where the ventilation and it is retrieving air from the open attic access, okay, from the attic access itself.
If I remember correctly, I'm going back 6 years now, okay, 7 years.
And look at that system and how it is set up. And get somebody, a heating and air person, to look at this and find out. Again,
I wouldn't have any objections.
I think that if we have to turn around and put something else in here to protect our employees, because I think it's coming down to that now, because now they're setting guidelines up.
And once you start violating these guidelines,
then you're going to have issues with liability. Would that be a correct statement, Mr. Attorney?
Yes. Yeah.
It looks like, John, that, you know, where we could get in trouble if we're not operating our units in agreement with manufacturer's instructions.
Absolutely.
It says it repeatedly through here. So if we are doing that, I think we're covered. Yes, but are we? That's the fact in terms of outside airflow and things like that. So, but that's something that we should be aware of anyway.
Correct.
I think, whether yes, we sir. Are or not. So.
And along with that, manager, while we do that here, we need to take a look at all our other facilities, especially such services, you know, because they have some problems, you know, a couple months ago that, you know,
yes,
and when we're doing that, we could kind of combine everything together. I'll get a better deal for your money.
And I do know one thing. Social Services has a chiller unit, and that is a whole different animal. And
a lot of issues with
what I'm talking about may not work over there, but
right.
Hopefully there would be something else that could be
right, exactly.
worked out. So. Right. Again, that's something we need to put, a priority on. Would everybody agree to that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, we sure do appreciate you.
Can we have a motion for that?
Oh, we will. Okay.
Yes,
can I have a motion?
So moved.
Okay. Have a second.
Second.
Okay. We have a first, Mr. Robinson, and also by second by Mr. Wesson. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you very much. Okay, county manager, approval of
code enforcement officer position.
You gonna speak about that? Or?
Yes, I can, and okay. Our HR is here to speak about it as well. But I think I've informed you all that we've had the building inspectors, but the one that we had on staff left. But this particular position that we like to hire for now, the building code enforcement officer, and right now we have two positions, one that's kind of like an entry level, one that is an administrator, and we want the one that's in the middle so that it can provide some certification to the lower level. So it's just a matter of getting this approved so that it's a part of our salary schedule, and we plan to move forward with hiring somebody as soon as we can find someone.
But at this time, we have no one.
We have no.
Okay. You need a motion on this?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The motion is going to be as well as approved in the development officer position.
It's going to pertain to, can I have a motion, please?
Back a motion.
I have a second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Next
one is approval of donations to trailer campers to Edgecombe County.
We absolutely have two. We started out with 16. We still have 10 citizens occupying them, so that leaves 10, and then minus that two should leave us with approximately 8. So we absolutely have to give to Edgecombe.
Okay.
So I should make the motion that we go forward with the that approval.
Thank you,
Mr. West. Can I have a second, please?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. All in favor?
Uh-huh.
Aye. Thank you.
Okay. The next thing that always creates a lot of discussion is approving the Berkshire County holiday schedule, the Berkshire County Board of Commissioners meeting schedule.
You're on.
So again, the 2022 holiday schedule is pretty standard. It's the state's holiday schedule in addition to our local Juneteenth holiday. And then the meeting schedule that you have here is just pretty much sticking to our Monday meetings where possible. Of course, we have some holidays in there. We have some work sessions that are built in, but it's all about if these dates will work for your schedule. And if not, of course, it can be amended as necessary so that we can get it approved for next year.
And again, we can amend some of these dates as we move throughout the year also.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. And two conferences that some of you like to attend have been taken into consideration. So these meetings should not conflict with the NACO conference of 2022, nor the NCACC conference.
Yeah. And the work sessions are, we put them in, but they are kind of optional. We're still going to do
absolutely
that.
Yes, sir.
Ron, I would say we easily move those around however it works for everybody. Does that work for everybody?
I'm good.
Okay. You need a motion on this or just consensus?
A motion, please.
Okay. Can I have a motion in reference to the schedule for Berkshire County Board of Commissioners meetings
and also the holiday schedule?
So move.
All right.
Approval Berkshire holiday schedule, Berkshire Board Commission meeting schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Can I have a second?
Second.
Okay. We have a first and a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you.
I'd like to
step back to the beginning of the agenda. I see in very small print your proper roll call, and I'll start it out. Commissioner Robertson?
Present.
Commissioner Wesson?
Present.
Commissioner Atkins?
Present.
Commissioner Trent? I'm present.
County Manager?
Present.
Okay.
Assistant County Manager?
Present.
Finance Officer?
Present. Mr. Attorney?
Present.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, I see we got Ms. Robin sitting in the audience. So, request to approve
destination by design
for Countrywide Branding and Marketing, Planning Services, Tall Glass Water, Site Y, Artifacts, and Travel and Tourism Discussion by Project Consultant Ms. Payne. That's a lot.
We won't be covering Site Y today. Just a mistake. We have more research that's being conducted just in-house before we're ready to sit down. What I would like to do is give you a quick update on a very productive meeting that we had with Destination by Design a couple weeks ago. We were getting estimates from two other firms, you know, for branding the entire thing. So, this PDF. David and Ms. Steve and I were able to have a Zoom meeting with Destination by Design a couple weeks ago. very productive. Like I said, they helped us work through the different approaches or steps rather. To county branding. So the basic targeted steps are research and discovery. They would come down and of course do a couple drive-throughs, spend some time in the county, meet with existing destination groups, talk to the county about different projects that are underway or planned for the future. They would then conduct independent research, site visits of different destination points. Again, meet with stakeholder and citizen focus groups, do a community branding survey. And then they showed us some of their past work. And it's pretty extensive, it's exciting. I think what's interesting here is that there is a definite flow, a consistent message that's developed with all, you know, throughout the county, so that logos can be used by businesses. Logos can be used by the county. We've got advertising materials. We've got website development. And again, you know, magazine advertisements. When you create marketing materials that have a message, a flow to the message, a design flow, everything's connected, it provides the visitor with a much more impact. They're able to understand the bigger picture of all of the assets and the exciting things to do in Vertee. So it was a great session. We'll go ahead and send you a copy of this PDF. Spindale, Cleveland County. I think if you scroll through here, you can see they've picked up on the assets, the things that stand out the most, you know, not only to the to the community, but also the traveling public. Great taglines. And we would also work with the group that's chosen to include Tall Glass of Water, because Tall Glass of Water is an ecotourism-based project, but there are other ecotourism-based projects out there too. So we want to create a theme, you know, amongst all the tourism projects. Lenoir, the Northern Peaks Trails. Vertee definitely has a place for designating a trail, a water trail, the Blue Way Trail. Life in Southern Virginia. T-shirt designs, billboards. Crazy about the billboards, but community themes for municipalities that are interested in downtown revitalization, assistance with that municipality, for them to be part of the message. Part of the overall theme is important. Identifying our core transportation pathways is important. How do we get that message of all of our great things to do? How do we get that message to the traveling public? You know, on those core roadways. So Boone, of course, is important. And then they gave us some feedback on overall master planning, but that's further down the road after you work on the branding. Piece of it. So by the next commissioners meeting, we'll have another estimate in so that we can see what type of money we're looking for. We do have branding money available in our budget, our USDA budget. So I'm comfortable that we won't need to seek any on the estimates that we've been seeing thus far. I don't think we'd be needing to go out and find any more grant funding to cover this portion of the branding. So.
I do have one just thought, okay, and maybe this doesn't have any place, and since you answered about that we have funding in place to cover it, but a lot of our partners here in Vertee spend individual money on doing some of the same work, whether that's Town of Windsor, my district, or Hope, or several others. So, and I know we're going to be talking to all of those partners about being in ours. Is there any possibility that they could help to some degree, small degree, but when you add all those pieces together, could be significant in terms of participating in the cost? A couple of thousand dollars here. Now, I'm just suggesting that because there's a great return and saves them money. Like I know at Hope, our budget is significant in terms of, you know, our identity on the web and all kinds of places. And we'd love to be a part. I'm sure we would. Free, but, you know, if there's a place to have a, you know, an input financially, it would be something we would certainly consider, maybe even the town of Windsor. And others.
It's a good idea, and it's part of the step, the process as we move forward. Meeting with everyone, the existing destinations, the existing municipalities, you know, getting all those folks to the table to help design the brand is important. And then when we move forward into the marketing piece of it, then I believe, and I'll research it, but I believe what you're suggesting, that's when that would come into play.
Okay. For instance, think about the town of Corinth that's just got historical recognition, right? And they're looking to publicize that in good, some way. Good. It could be a real nice piece for them.
Yeah, it helps all of us, you know? Yeah, we all come together, so.
Yes, Rob, you're doing a great job. But I'm gonna piggyback off of Commissioner Wesson. I had just wrote some notes down about sponsorships and things in the county that everybody, it will make everybody feel like that they are part of, you know, and they belong to, you know, just like Commissioner Wesson said, you know, it will really engage and everybody feel, you will have that more engagement and more participation and everybody in the county will, you know, felt like they was a stakeholder of the beach. You know, just like my business, you know, we'd be, my business would donate X number of dollars for to have their name on a bench, things of that nature, you know. And the bench could be used for anybody who wants to sit, anybody who wants to lay down, you know, a different thing. It will help advertise the businesses in the county and other businesses that want to participate.
Sure.
But that's a great idea, Commissioner. Yeah. Great idea, man. You know, and I just written some notes down. And, you know, if you wanted to, you could earmark, you know, all the donations be a special project for the donation that you receive to be contributed towards. Great.
Yeah.
Well, question. This goes back a couple months ago when we had Rob and I think Steve was with you. We had a meeting with the architects and it was reference to construction drawings and move forward and looking at the, I'm gonna call it used term amphitheater, but it wasn't an amphitheater. We called it something else.
Stage,
something of that nature. Did we ever get clarification as far as what that price consisted of? Because they had several examples up there, but we didn't know if that price consisted for all of these. Because I remember one of them was made out of engineered wood with the arches and things of that nature.
And we had a follow up and. That's first, and then second, are they proceeding forward with the construction drawings? Because that is something that I think the board, and please y'all step in if I'm not correct, wanted to move forward with, because there's nothing that we can do without the construction drawings. And that would have to do with, of course, infrastructure and things of that nature. Do we know what those answers are at this time, or do you need to follow back up with us?
Answer to the stage is that the price that was included in the original estimate was the basic stage design connected to the open pavilion. And in that commissioner's meeting that you're referring to, that's what y'all had said you felt was the best way to go, was the simple stage that was attached to the open pavilion.
Okay.
So we did not move forward in pricing out that.
Yeah. Well, that's fine if the board agreed to and all that. I'm
quite sure. I think that was just one more question. That price fit this and how many square feet is this going to be so that
right.
we know how big this stage is going to be and also the pavilion that you're talking about.
I don't think we had any square footages on the pavilion that we were on. I don't remember.
I don't think our intent was to obligate ourselves, but to say this is what we'd like to get more information about in terms of the cost, the size, that, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay. So I will get back with Vines to revisit that. The construction drawings are completed, the preliminary construction drawings. They've been submitted to the different permit offices for T County. They've gotten some feedback from the inspectors, minor changes, you know, such as on our faucets in the bathroom, make sure they're auto shut off, things like that. So those are completed. Right now, we have a Vines meeting today at 4 p.m. Progress meeting. Our well test is completed. Majette Drilling pulled off the job. I think they have one more piece of equipment there, but they left the site last Thursday. So, you know, we're moving forward with Vines. We don't anticipate any holdups in the construction. I'm reading articles where materials costs are starting to come down a tiny bit. Yep. Let's hope we're right on that, you know, that going down swing. And we're waiting to hear from our grant applications that were into Water Resources Development Group. And we should know by October 15th.
On those construction drawings, I assume they have electrical hookup. Has anybody made contact with the electrical service out there, whether it was Dominion or Roanoke? I don't know who it is, in reference to putting the poles and services, would that be something they could do that would be no charge or something of that nature? Would that then converge with them?
You mean it's Roanoke? You mean for temporary service to the site?
Or well,
you
I'm mean for the about final? Service once we get going. Now, we talked about solar, but solar without request.
But
somebody's going to have to run the electrical
overhead or either underground, one or
the other. Okay. And is that going to be a cost factor to the county, or is our local Roanoke, if it's, is it Roanoke or is it Dominion?
Roanoke.
Okay. Since Roanoke is our electrical co-op here, and they have a lot of business from us as far as our citizens and also countywide, would that be something that they would do as a grant or a something that no charge to Bertie County?
Okay.
So that we can spend that money in other areas.
Okay.
Yeah, has anybody addressed that with
us? I'll research that with Steve.
Okay.
Yeah.
Robert, I'd like to take a look at the plans, you know, maybe at the next meeting or prior to that. That you said the plan's been finalized. I'd like to take a look at them, just see the layout.
No problem. Got to set up in my office.
That's an excellent idea.
Yeah.
If that's where it was for the next meeting, maybe we'll get up to speed as far as those construction drawings, so we can just have a review.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Does have anything else from this plan?
No, I would say one thing. No, Robin. When we just thinking about the electrical work, right? Right now, if you look at Golden Leaf, and I was reading through their kind of monthly report of projects that they funded. Mm-hmm. They're doing a lot of infrastructure grants. I mean, the grant that they gave to our teacher housing project is specifically an infrastructure that would cover things like the electrical, the water, sewer, all of that, right? So that would might be, and they've been very good to Bertie, as we well know, right? So, and they have still have a lot of money. So we might want to look at them for that.
Commissioner Boyce is correct on that, because I think that the school project, the school teacher project, that gives $250,000. And if I'm mistaken, the amount of money that they gave us for the Lewiston project that we did was $200,000
sure.
One or the other.
I was on a call with them last week, and in that resilience fund, this is important because the resilience fund has to do with associated with disaster, waterfront kind of things could fit into that. They got $250,000 still in that fund right now, and no request for that money at present. That's $250,000. So,
okay.
kind of the first people who can get it on board, kind of get some.
Four things. So I'll get back to you.
Thank you. Anybody have any other questions, statements? Robin, thank you very much for everything
you're
doing.
You're
welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Next person will be up. The infamous Assistant County Manager, David Scarborough. In
reference to evaluation process, Mr. Scarborough.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Well, we're excited about this. If you recall, one of the things that was mentioned during my interview process, the employee personnel evaluation was something that was long overdue and something that we wanted to get started on. One of the first tasks that was assigned to me when I got here. For the last several months, Courtney and I have been, our HR director and I have been working on this evaluation process, and I'm here to tell you a little bit about the evaluation process and how we started the initial rollout on this by introducing it to the department head. But what I wanted to tell you is that several of the things I found out during the budget process and in talking to the department heads is that we have employees that have been here 20, 24, 28 years. And in discussing the evaluation process with them, they all agreed that they had never had one. So it's about time we got started on one. So we tried to make it this process simple, but still something worth, you know, worth our time and effort. You know, the whole idea was, you know, when we looked at the budget process, we had a lot of different department heads who were saying, Joe needs a raise because he's been doing a good job, or I got a certification last month, I should get a raise because I got the certification. But there's never been a justification behind that, nor has there been any way for any department head or supervisor to determine if an employee is reaching their potential, to see where they might need improvement, and talking with them about that and working with them to develop a plan in order to improve their performance, rather than you're not doing a good job, you know, to get better type of thing. You know, and that's one of the things about this is with the evaluation, the performance evaluation, you know, this is just a way to overall to improve the overall performance. It's a way to improve the employee engagement between the department heads, the supervisors, and the employee. It's a way to set goals for the employee that make them feel like they're trying to reach their potential and to improve. It helps us as employers to establish training needs, training ability, you know, different training processes in order to help them to improve. It develops communication and strength. I think it strengthens the relationship between the employees and the departments. And then it also recognizes those people who are going above and beyond, who are not just doing their role, but improving their overall job performance and doing things that are helping the county and improving the services to the county. So what we did was, and you can't see this on this form, but you have a copy of it in your packet. And I'm not going to go over all of it real firmly, real long here, but this is the evaluation process. It answers 10 questions. It evaluates 10 different tasks, job performances that are fairly common for each department, each person, each role. But it focuses on the mission of the department. It focuses on the job description of the employee, and you go through there and it talks about different things such as professionalism, communication, problem solving, safety, attitude, and it addresses, you know, it goes anywhere from doesn't meet expectations in order to exceeds expectations. We introduced this to the department heads, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, and one of the things we explained to them was as you rank your employee, beats expectation, doesn't meet expectations or exceeds, or even if you do, you're just doing your job, we're going to require that they put comments in there, explain what they see about the employee's performance in areas they felt they might be deficient, areas they felt they might be doing more than they should. But every one of those is going to be a description and a comment about it so that we can see from that they've actually spent some time working with the employee, and the employee understands this. The second page, we're talking about goals. And what we're going to require the department heads and the supervisors is to meet with the staff. And first off, we're going to be training them on how to develop SMART goals and how to develop goals that are that address not only their performance, but how their performance can improve performance and the mission of the department and the overall service to the county. And we'll be establishing goals. We're going to establish three goals for each employee. And then over the course of the year, we're going to have the department heads and supervisors who are evaluating these employees meet with them just to make sure that they're meeting these goals. And at the end of the year, we'll be discussing the goal process with them, see if it needs to be changed in any way or continued on, or establish new goals if they've met these. So, and then this form actually gives you a chance for the employee to give comments and the supervisor to give comments. And then the last page is really a place for the director to review it and all that. So this is the, that's the form that we've developed. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the timeline. We started in October. We had our department, September. We had our department head meeting. We brought them all in. We went through this form. I actually put the form up online and showed them how to fill it out, complete it. We discussed it. We had another portion of the meeting that talked about SMART goals and how to establish them and why they were important. We answered a lot of questions from the department heads. And between now and October the 25th, we're going to be meeting with the department heads to go to explain the goal development a little bit more and work with them. And then on October the 25th, when we have our next department head, we're going to be actually doing a workshop basically on how to do it. We're getting some homework ahead of time so that when they get there, they will have some goals set up, and we're going to establish that. After we've done that, then we're going to start rolling it out to the staff. We're going to start having meetings with the staff. I'll go back just a second. The department heads aren't the only ones who are going to be doing the evaluations. The supervisors will also be doing it. So between now and October 25th, we'll be meeting with the supervisors as well and training them on this process. So in November, we're going to start rolling it out to the staff and introduce the evaluation process, explain why it's important. Basically the same presentation we gave to everybody else, but you know, on an individual basis, and start talking to them about thinking about how to develop goals for their position. And then in December, the department heads and supervisors are going to be responsible for meeting with their staff, going over their goal setting and setting up goals and being prepared to do that, discussing the evaluation process and the forms a little bit more so they have a firm concept of it. And so nothing's going to be surprising. Nobody's going to be, you know, I didn't know I had to do that or anything like this. And then in January, we're going to start the evaluation process. We're going to roll it out. We're going to start it. I explain the overall process as we get started, how we're going to handle this on a regular basis. January 15th is going to be the deadline for all evaluations going forward. And then there's reasons behind that. And first off, I'll tell you about all the evaluations will be done, turned into HR for review. And then new goals, if they do need to establish new goals, they'll be reestablished. And because obviously each year you don't want the same goals to be going over and over, because you're going to meet it. You're really not challenging your employees or improving their performance if you don't look at new goals. So the whole idea behind this is all the evaluations are turned in by January the 15th so we can review them, so that when the budget process starts and you start submitting your request for Joe needs a raise because he's done such a good job, you have support to back it up. It may not guarantee that he gets it yet until we roll out that piece about the merit pay, which will, as we get this going, this is kind of setting a basis for that. If we do, and when we're able to start rolling out merit-based pay, this gives us the support we need in order to use the, to do the, do that. So starting in January, everybody's evaluation process will start again. In mid-July, we're going to ask for a mid-year review, that all the supervisors and department heads are meeting, making sure that they're at least touching base with their employees on how it's being done, how they're performance is looking. And then in December, the evaluation process will start again. It'll be like everyone will be reviewed. Everything will be taken care of and done and signed off on and submitted to HR by January 15th again. So that'll be the cycle that we go on. And that's pretty much a broad overview of it. Really excited about it because we think this this is going to get us started in the direction that we want to go. And so I'm here to answer any questions.
David, thank you for the effort and getting all this stuff. It's been way past. We've had a conversation about how many times.
Long time. And you've got a good system, it seems, put up. Everybody's going to be evaluated fairly, or everybody's going to be briefed by their by yourself and also department heads. We have an HR person, which we're thankful for, and all that. So thank you for getting that put together. That is just something that has been way past overdue. But since we're on that subject, you don't mind.
No.
Since we're on that subject,
county manager,
we needed to
review you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Commissioner Lee, I think, has mentioned this to you. I think the format that you have here, I haven't read it completely. Okay. But
I don't think the board would have any issues using this same format for county manager, or would we want to use the old format? That's a question that I wanted to throw out there for everybody.
I certainly don't like the old format personally. This could be good, but there are a lot of other models out there, I'm sure, about, you know, evaluating managers. And the thing we have to be careful for is I've always found is that, you know, when we do it, you know, but we haven't set expectations around how we're going to evaluate it, sometimes a little bit unfair the first time, but it gives but it does give a stake place in the ground, right?
Right.
So as long as we all understand that, right, we can go forward. But I have seen some other models out there, and I'm sure Courtney has too, that might be more applicable, but I really did not like the other one. This could work.
Okay.
You know, but whatever.
Okay. So let's circulate some models among the board, and then once we decide on one.
Yeah, and I think that's the right route. I really
do. Yeah, that's fair.
This is the one.
No, this is a heck of a lot better than
I'll be glad to meet with y'all. Let's talk to you a little bit more about this afterwards or before, you know, at another time. I'm here.
I do have one question. I really like this. I really like the simplicity of it, right? Easy to do. But let me ask one question. Please. And I've had a little bit of experience in HR, but have we ever given any thought to a 365 degree kind of look at appraisal where employees also have a part in evaluating their supervisor, which could also help? Right now, I think, you know, the supervisor always evaluates the employee, but I've seen it very effective when the employees have a way of evaluating their supervisor, even if it's in the blind, so that the ultimate supervisor has some better view of how the relationship between the supervisor and his employees. Something to consider, but I've seen that be very effective. A lot of companies are going to that.
We didn't consider that during this process. It was more just trying to get a basis
get it going.
In place. We can certainly look at that in the future. I'd feel more comfortable once we've done it for a year to then introduce something like that.
Something I like that idea, Ron.
Yeah. And you know, you can use something, you can actually use this very same thing to evaluate, because all the same criteria is there, right? But you're right, you may be too much at one time, but it is extremely effective, I found anyway.
The other question I had is this: everybody, for example, can't imagine Mr. Turner. I think it'd be wise for you to review the contract with the county manager, okay, and determine if it was written into the contract itself about an evaluation and when the evaluation should be done, okay? Because I know there's been a conversation about evaluations, but again, if this contract calls for it, it calls for a certain length of time, we need to abide by that contract, okay? And if we are past it, then that's something that we need to get up to date ASAP. We need to take note of that. My next question is this: county manager, you'll be one giving the evaluation as far as all your other management staff, correct? The department head level, say?
Most department heads, not all.
Okay, well, tell me who would fall under you and not Dave at the time, right?
Well, actually, I'm doing all of the department heads as far as the evaluation is concerned. The department heads who I won't evaluate are those who are elected, those who report to their own board. everyone else.
Okay. So you need to personally get finance, assistant county manager,
yes.
HR,
yes.
Zone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, building inspector, but no building inspector.
We do not
have we still do not have an inspector that does health department inspector. Health inspectors for we're still going through. You intend to get that done from their inspector?
We're going through Liberty City.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So we wouldn't have that Don Highsmith being retired.
Right. We have Danielle, who's I need to figure out exactly how long she'll be here, but Danielle is up with Albemarle. She's in his office right now. But yes, from my understanding, she will be leaving us soon.
Is she even a county employee or is she more of a state employee?
No, she's not county.
District.
Yeah. It's good. Maybe that's a rationale I don't see, but you mentioned not doing an evaluation of elected employees or those who report to the separate board. Why would we not? Because we do the increases for those people. How are we going to evaluate that increase without knowing
that before? That's a good question. So that's something that I think we definitely need to talk about, particularly when merit-based pay comes into effect, because of course, everyone will be evaluated by his supervisor, department head, or county manager. However, when it comes to certain department heads, such as the elected officials, they don't necessarily have, they don't report to a manager on a day-to-day basis. So whether or not you all would like to do some type of evaluation to determine if they should have a certain, should receive that merit-based pay, or that's up for us to discuss exactly how that would be done. But again, because they don't report to me on a day-to-day basis, it's not the thought that I would actually perform their evaluation.
Yeah, you would, and that is looking at be done in the past.
Right.
Well, yeah, I don't want to get in weeds, but we still approve those folks' raises.
And what folks exactly?
The registered like official gets paid by the county. We're approving.
Give me an example. I'm sorry.
The registered D, the sheriff, any of those elected officials, we give them determine their raise every year. So without that, I don't see the negative side of evaluating people who work for the county at some level. And how you use that evaluation is another thing. But to not have a way of evaluating people, I don't know. Just seems a little odd, especially when you said those who are they people who report to a board who are not elected?
Yes, Cindy, here, DSS director, reports to a board.
Okay.
Sheila Holloman, the director of elections, reports to a board.
Right. And we did, but we determined those folks' salaries, right? So that would be very strange to me if those folks, we would not evaluate them.
I guess the point I was trying to make, is that someone who is elected in that position, hypothetically, the sheriff, hypothetically, registers the things of that nature. They are their own, sheriff is a constitutional officer who's elected that position, registers the same thing.
No, not a constitutional.
Well, I didn't say constitutional, right. But she is elected to that position.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she is being judged and determined by the people who elected her. That's who she's being judged by.
They don't do an evaluation. Nobody at the state level evaluates your registered D.
That's a path I would not want to cross.
I think there are two things, John. I agree that on elected officials, you're getting a little hairy. But on others who report to a board, like our elections person or DSS or whatever, to me, a little different animal.
Now, again.
These people are reporting to a board who has the sole power of hiring or firing these people. Okay, is that not correct? It comes to DSS.
Yes.
That I think now we're starting to get into the weeds. The evaluation should be done by the boards. Us, unless you can find where somewhere county commissioners are doing the evaluation of people who are hired by a board. I don't know if that exists.
And Cindy is completely hired by her board. We don't have input in that.
We have a representative
from among the bid board and our board.
Right. Yes, you somebody.
And Ms. Holloman is we who puts her in place.
We, as in the Board of Commissioners, put her. She reports to the board. I can take a look at this, but I would like to think.
Well, maybe more.
I think we should look at it.
Yeah, and I think so too. You can look at that. Right. But somebody who is elected to a position like the sheriff or the region, I have to say, I'm not interested in those meetings. You have a board, for example, like DSS,
who hires and has the capabilities of letting that person go. I don't know if I want to get in the weeds there, because now you're now taking control of that board's responsibility. Now, as your county manager,
I know that you meet with Ms. Perry and things of that nature, and you do meet with the board members. And
I am.
And I think that possibly with you being on that board, that maybe you need to take that to the chairman of the board and make that a conversation as far as the evaluation by your board on that person that is in charge of DSS. And again, going to your point, not a debate, just to your point, that the elections board has the same, if I'm not mistaken, okay, has the same type of authority, okay, that the DSS board does. And I wouldn't want to ever try to circumvent a board of their power, because we put them in that position. But they do need to be doing similar same things that we're doing. And then I do know you have contact and you do work sort of hand in hand with DSS if there's an issue, okay? And we've got to answer questions to, you know, issues. So that may be something that you would want to walk in there. As far as elected officials, I would have to say I'm completely against that.
I would be in favor of certainly having a conversation with those boards, because I think in many cases they might welcome an evaluation from the county. Doesn't mean that they can't do their own thing or fire what they want to do. But in many ways, we may be actually closer to what that person does than they are, especially in some boards. So it's a possibility and something to consider. And having that dialogue with them, you might be surprised at the response you get. They might welcome that.
Yes, very well.
Yeah. David, I just bet horse, not to kick that
dead horse, but county manager, you're going to get the information as far as the evaluation
for our
county attorney, evaluation for our county manager.
Okay.
Or if it does state in the contract, and would it be suitable that he just
emails us that date?
Commissioner, as far as what that is, okay. And then we turn around from there. And David, I assume David will put together something for county management evaluation. And then we can use this.
Ron, you had mentioned something else also. I'm just
recapping and make sure these things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And go with
that. Yeah. And the nice part about using, if we go with another form, it's always good to get a self evaluation from the person. A lot of times we do it where the manager evaluates themselves. We get to see that. We also get to compare it, especially even in the goal setting area when we go forward. You know, I would love to have input from you on what the goals should be for us to consider in setting those goals going forward. So it should be a, you know, partnership around that.
I think you're going to need to evaluate your reports for us to grade that.
I'd just like to say to them, impressed at the depth y'all have seen have gone through in developing this process, because it's not a simple thing. Having been through some of these evaluations myself with the county in the past, I think one of the biggest challenges you're going to have is gaining the employees' confidence that these things are totally objective, because they have not always been in the past. And you know, when they get the perception that they are subjective, then they cause more problems than they solve. So, yes.
And that's the reason we need to have real goals, right? Measurable, tangible goals going forward, right? So we have something to hang our hats on.
And another thing, David, I would think at some point in time, it'd probably be brought up from some of the employees as well as myself. It may be how we can look at some incentives in the future. Well, you know, the employee that go well beyond their duty and responsibility and saves the county money. You know what I mean? So, you know, I know some organizations and government and some private have a person save them thousands and, you know, of dollars, you know, that they give them some type of incentive. But just something to think about.
It is something to think about. And I'm just going to say from past experience with that, it's very, you have to be very careful.
Right, because, sure.
You know, the way I look at this is, you know, we're given a certain amount of taxpayers are assuring us that we're going to be using their funds to us in an appropriate way. And I have seen in the past that there have been concerns that if I'm going to reward somebody for doing it, for saving us money with some of that taxpayer money, taxpayers tend to question that. But there are ways to do it, and I agree with you. And should we find employees that are doing that, there are ways to do that. We can introduce some of that in the future as well.
Right, in the future.
I want to touch base. You're correct in that objectivity is what we need to make sure that we're taking care of, which is one of the reasons why when we're doing the goal setting, the employees are going to be part of it. They're not going to be surprised. I'm not going to walk up to you and say, all right, Greg, so for the next year, I expect you to meet this, and this goal. Get to it. And then, you know, you have no say so in it. And when, or I don't want to set the goals for you. And then at the end of the year, you didn't meet such and such goal and you didn't have a clue about it, you know? So that's definitely, this is going to be a back and forth conversation before we get to the evaluation process. And that's also why that comment piece on that, those first 10, on all of them actually, are going to have that. You're going to need to put, if you're evaluating this employee, you're going to need to put why you're giving them this ranking. And at the end of it, the employee has a chance to respond and make comments. So this is going to be a back and forth. This is not going to be just the supervisor doing it. So I agree. That's one of the things we tried to make sure that it was a very objective, very collaborative document.
Thank you.
There's not any more questions. We'll move forward. Okay. Request to amend retirement policy. HR risk management. Ms. Courtney, you're up the bat again.
So we received a request from an employee regarding our retirement policy. We went ahead and took a look at the policy as it's written to possibly account for gaps of service where an employee remained part-time. I put together a few scenarios as far as possible costs or liability for the county if this policy is amended. To account for those gaps. If you look at your included scenario sheet, employee number one hired in January 2002, went down to part-time January of 2005, went back to full-time August of 2006. That left a gap of 18 months. Now, if we fill the gap, or if we recognize that gap and we refer back to the original hire date, according to how the policy is currently written, that person would have the opportunity to retire in January of 2022. If we observe the policy as written and we count the 20 years of retirement from the rehire date, because that's how the policy states we should do, they would retire in August of 2026. And there's also another option in our retirement policy where an employee can work 25 years of non-continuous service. And this employee would be able to retire in January of 2028. And I do want to take a step back. When I say an employee is eligible to retire, what I mean is our policy allows the employee to receive 100% of their medical and dental benefits paid. Of course, the retirement system is a whole different ballpark and they have a whole different set of regulations for when an employee can retire. This is specific to Burton County retirement policy and the medical coverage. So in summary, as far as cost, the employee is retiring at least 55 years sooner, months sooner if we observe that 18 month gap. This could possibly result in at least $62,000 more than what the county would pay if the employee retired according to how the policy is written. So basically, the policy as it's written now allows the employee to retire August of 2026. If we observe the gap, they retire about 4 years earlier. That takes into account roughly what we pay for pre-65 and roughly what we pay for COBRA. Because the way our retirement process works is employee retires, they go into COBRA for 18 months. After they get off of COBRA, they go to our pre-65 plan. When they hit 65, they go to our supplemental Part D plan. Now, all of these scenarios are also assuming that the employee does not turn 65 within that period of time of retiring a few years earlier and with how the policy is written to where they can retire. Any questions on the first scenario? We'll go ahead to the second one. So employee's original hire date is June of 2010. They go part-time in December of 2014, rehired in September of 2015. This time it's a 9-month gap. If we observe that gap, the employee is able to retire in June of 2030. If we observe how the policy is written as is, they would retire in August of 2035, or excuse me, September of 2035. And of course, the 25 years non-continuous service, they could retire in February of 2036. In this scenario, the employee is retiring about 5 years sooner. If we observe that gap, or if we close it, which could result in roughly $69,000 additional. And when I say additional, each couple of years, we do an actuarial study on the cost for our retirees and how much we should put aside to pay for their insurance. And it accounts for how the policy is currently written. And if we amend this policy, that additional 62 in the first scenario, 69,000 in the second scenario, is in addition to what they've already calculated. Or yes, sir.
Question. Okay. If the person paid that back to the county, then they would gain full benefit. If they would pay the gap.
That $62,000 or $69,000?
Right.
So, yeah. So,
this. If I'm saying of a person, my experience has been if I left NCDOT, I stayed away 5 years. And if I took my money and came back to work, then if I gave the money back, then that would buy my time back.
Are you talking about like in the first scenario, the 18
right.
months?
Right.
So
all the 9 months.
Well, yeah. So as far as the cost and the liability to the county,
right,
that would be a very small fraction of the additional amount that we would be paying for them to retire so many years early. So if we refer back to like the second scenario, the employee, and you, with regards to your question, they would just be purchasing, let's say, the medical insurance for that 9 months.
Right.
That's a couple thousand dollars, few thousand dollars.
It doesn't touch with the other is.
And I don't have to interrupt you. I'm going to ask this question. How many employees would we have approximately? I don't think you would know exactly that this could possibly be involved that could affect us in the long run. I see us, not the commissioners, but Bertie County citizens. Okay.
So what we're doing is we're taking a look at a group of roughly 75 employees. Those are the employees that are eligible, that would be eligible for this amendment. And we're taking a look and we're going to go back and do an audit of how many of them have actually gone part-time for a period of time and would have the opportunity to participate in this policy. In this policy, if it's amended, it's going to take a little bit of time.
Okay. So you're saying that 75 employees could have do this if we change the policy, is that correct? That there would be a gap here of $60,000 to $62,000 depending on how many months it is, correct?
So I would say only if any one of those 75 or any group of that 75 went part-time for a certain period of time. It's possible that 90% of those 75 employees have been, working 20 years or close to 20 years straight. as far as this amendment, we're assuming that the employee, one of those or a group of those 75 employees have gone part-time for a period of time. And that's why the audit's gonna take a little bit of time, because first we have to identify who they are, which we have. Then we have to see what the system has. And in some cases, the system may not have the dates recorded appropriately. So we have to pull their file, which has all hard copies of.
So hypothetically, if I just use your number that we're talking about, and hypothetically it's 70, because I can't do math, long division and stuff, but anyhow, and you got 60,000, you got 70 people, you're almost talking $4.2 million, correct?
Hypothetically.
Yeah, you're only talking about those, though, who actually had a part-time correct length of service out of those 75, right? Correct. And we control that, right? I mean, those who have already had it is the number we need to identify. What's that universe, right?
Right.
Of those who have served on a part, were full-time, went into mm-hmm. a part-time, because those are the only ones that this policy could affect.
Right.
But
right.
Again, I think what Ms. Moore's trying to say is that, and again, she's still got to gather more information before I make a decision on this, but
I think what she's trying to say is that if we did change that policy, those 70 or 76 people could say, hey, I'm going to go part time. Okay. And if.
Well, no.
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 Because at okay. this point, the way that our policy, it's been amended once
right.
before.
Right.
And it cut off continuous service back in July of 2016.
Okay.
So if any of our full-time employees who were hired before 2016 go part-time at this point or anytime after 2016
or before
anytime right? after
okay but the yeah. point I'm talking about before okay
okay
if yes. they were hired before 2016 because I remember
no they had to have gone part-time before 16.
So rehired before right 2016.
Okay well let me ask you a question, that 76, is there a possibility those 76 people have done this or that they're
that's what we're looking for
yeah
okay but you threw a pretty definite number out there, so it kind of makes me think that you're on that you're like a bloodhound, you're on that trail, and that it has no offense.
I'm just saying
that you've researched this enough that you get a strong possibility this could be what the deal could be. I mean, you
don't know yet.
No.
You worked away on the information,
mm-hmm. but you've identified something here that could be astronomical.
Those 76 are just people with
yeah,
broken
just,
service.
Right.
Yeah,
so that's those 76 employees.
Small
yeah, very small.
Right. Are yeah. employees who were hired before 2016. Yeah. So I guess there's a good chunk of those who are at the end of 2013. You know, those yeah. folks who are hired in that group, unless they went part-time before 2016 and were rehired, they would count. But
well, I guess that's where I misunderstood what you were saying. But that is
there.
It's not total
76. No. That's just our group that yeah. we're
yeah,
looking at.
It's just the group that you evaluate.
Yes, sir.
It could be a heck of a lot smaller.
Than yes, sir.
A lot smaller. And we have, yeah, and we have control over those who may have gone part-time, could still be part-time, but whether or not we return them to a full-time service, right?
Well, the way the policy was, this retirement policy was last amended, if you were rehired or hired after 2016,
then you
would.
So we're right. talking about the only universe of those prior to 16
right.
exactly.
who went part-time and came back mm-hmm. to full-time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's going to.
And that's the X in the
decimal.
Equation here. We got to find out what that right. is.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And I'm working closely with Samantha. Mm-hmm. Our payroll management specialist.
Small, and small tech part of
that came back.
Would you like me to continue to the third scenario?
Go ahead.
Yes, sir. So, third employee, original hire date, December 2001, part time date, or went part time, December of 2002. That's a gap of 12 months. Or, excuse me. The rehire date in December of 2004, that's a gap of 24 months. If we observe the gap and filling it, the employee would be eligible to retire December of 2001. And if they have 20 years of continuous service at their rehire date, they retire in December of 2024. And of course, the 25 years of non-continuous service, they could retire in December of 2028. This employee would be retiring approximately 3 years sooner.
that leaves, that would be a cost of at least $35,000 more than what we had originally anticipated for Anchor's employees' retirement. And again, this is taking into account 18 months of COBRA and multiplying the additional months by the pre-65 rate that we have. So upon discussion with the county manager and our finance staff, we feel the only way the county will not incur additional cost or liability for allowing the gap to be filled is if the employee that went part-time, it comes back full-time, covers the additional cost as far as the additional dollar amount for retiring so many months or so many years sooner.
You're talking about paying the entire amount from
I'm trying to think how this works.
You're talking about paying the entire amount from the time that he would be able to retire,
right?
Based on this, that would just give him the benefit of having his health insurance from that point on for the rest of his life.
Correct.
That he would not have unless he bought that all of that time.
Right. So it's not the gap of his of their part time; it's the gap of how much sooner they're retiring than what how the policy or what the policy or when the policy says they would retire as it's currently written.
And so if that employee chose to do that, right, was amenable to that, what impact would that have on the county? Because they're paying the fee that we would have incurred, right? Or what? How does that impact us?
So I would say if the employee was able to cover that cost,
right,
that retiring 3 years earlier, 15 months earlier. As far as our actuarial study, I'd say the gap that they are not accounting for, if it's being covered by the employee, I don't really see a loss unless, yeah, of course, in that period of time, the rates shoot up, because we would base the cost on what the rates are now.
Couldn't you just let them pay it per year? Can you just let them pay the county per year for what their insurance cost that year until they were eligible for the county to start paying for?
That's up to.
I mean, is there a reason not to be able to do that?
Well, I thought that was, because I thought the question was, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but if I pay that fee, right, that extends my length of service with the company. I mean, with the county, right?
Which because means they can retire
so then,
early.
Well, yeah, but it also means that it increases the number of years I quote my service years.
Right.
So that impacts how much county's going to have to pay me.
That's where the large amount of money comes up.
That's
the
right.
$62,000 or the $58,000 or right. the $60,000. And I think to Commissioner Atkins, I think you, if I understood what you were trying to say, what if they paid that money back to the county on a year? Is that's not what you were saying?
No, he was just saying the insurance fee.
I got
what saying.
Well,
instead of paying that gap, that end gap that you're talking about, if that gap is going to cost, we're projecting it's going to cost $60,000 from the time that they're eligible to retire now to the time they would be eligible, then instead of paying the $60,000 lump sum, couldn't they just buy their insurance per year for that through that gap?
I'm not sure if that's something that we
consider. You'd have to really look at the legalities of that also.
But if they did, right, if they paid that insurance gap, which is our the current cost piece, but doesn't that lengthen their service time in terms of what they ultimately get in terms of retirement income from the county?
No, this is just health insurance here.
I guess the way I'm understanding the question is, instead of, let's say, you all allow employee number one to retire in January of 2022 instead of retiring in August of 2026, that additional cost is roughly $62,000. Let me know if I'm understanding this correctly. Instead of paying the $62,000 up front, just pay the cost incrementally
per
year until 2026.
That's right. Until you got to that point, and then the county will pick it up.
But let me ask you.
Whoa, you're talking about full.
I got to follow up on it just so I understand, because I may have misunderstood that right there. The $62,000 hypothetically is the actual retirement pay, correct?
That it's right. We're
that's just purely the health insurance is going to be $62,000.
That's all we're talking about here is health insurance.
From that period. Yes, okay. Sir. That's what I want to be clear on, because state retirement, county retirement interconnects here somehow, and I didn't know how that was working towards all this. Does that make sense what I just said?
Yes.
And if that is the case, how would that work? Because if I'm not mistaken, the county pays into the state retirement fund, correct?
Right.
I understand that. I'm now changed to the piece of somebody retiring early. Okay. And if they retire early, their benefit, retirement benefits, is going to be the same as it normally would be if they retired early.
I would think so, because they're not being processed in our payroll. We're just paying their medical bills.
Okay.
Like we're paying their medical.
No, I understand that, but we have to pay a part in that. You follow what I'm saying? As we go along, we're paying a certain amount of money every year into somebody's retirement account, correct?
Yeah. I thought we only contributed if they were active employees.
I think the two things could be completely separate.
It could be.
Well, that was kind of the question. Yes, and I am saying, they're completely separate. I am saying they could be completely separate. Could be. But I think that is the B of the A and B that needs to be researched. So we aren't having to cough up that end also. Does everybody follow what I'm trying to say here? I don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
The state retirement plan for the county type deal here. But I'm thinking that I just don't want to get caught in catch 22. Yeah.
You're right. Head. Sometimes the common sense answer isn't always the answer.
Exactly.
So it wouldn't hurt to make sure.
Yeah, because I think when you start dealing with labor laws and you start dealing with these people that could be retiring early and this, that, and the other, but they're going to get this. But we're saying really it gets very complicated.
Yeah.
And that's what I call getting in the weeds again, okay? And if we're not researching it far enough out and asking the right questions, and obviously you know more about it than I do. You obviously know more about it than the rest of these commissioners. And I don't know about the county manager or the assistant county manager or finance, but I think these are questions that need to be found out along with the other questions that you have referenced the gap with the health insurance. It could be $62,000. Okay. Because I wouldn't want us to get caught in a catch 22 because we have not asked the right questions. Okay. And if we don't know the question to ask, then it could bite us at the end. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
that's where I'm going with all this.
I guess I think it's a very good point. I think they can be completely separate, but I'm not 100% sure.
And neither am I. Right. I'm just asking that question. I know I probably didn't ask it right for everybody to understand it, but so I'm trying to get it out there.
Okay. Common sense would tell you they could be, but that's not always.
That's not always true.
It's a simple matter. If the employee was allowed to pay it, that's great for them, but does it incur an additional liability for the county, even though it's simply the medical piece, right? And if it doesn't, then great, right?
So if I was eligible, let's say I had broken service, and if I continued to work, I would be eligible for my health benefits, to get my health benefits in 26. But I decided I wanted to leave today. If this is a hypothetical situation, if I just paid the county for my health insurance at the cost of what my health insurance was from now until 26, then the county would pay me at the time that I would normally be able to retire. Is that an option that we're talking about?
Well, that would make up the gap that you're talking about.
And would our insurer allow us to do that?
That's exactly right.
Would it allow us to, for an employee who's not technically employed, active employed for the county, be covered? I don't think they would.
To your point.
You can't do it.
To your point, Mr. Wesson and Greg, insurance companies today, they look no different than what we did when we hired an actuary, okay, to come in and prepare us of what the future may bring. And they have got this thing nailed down to a point that they have a comprehension 40 years out of what this price tag on insurance is going to be. And they're looking at this, and they're looking at the health and well-being as people get older. That's one reason Blue Cross Blue Shield has, called Wellcraft, has separate corporations in every state, not the same thing throughout the country. Why? Because the demographics in South Carolina are completely different than the demographics in North Carolina, as they are in Arkansas, Mississippi, and they try to fade themselves away from the liability factor of what they're going to have to pay and how they're going to have to pay it and what it's the extension of this payment is going to be. So to y'all's point, I think it's going to cost us more, okay, as someone gets older, and it's just not that flat rate right now where they're at.
Right.
That's my point, okay? Back to the insurance point, not insurance, but the retirement point also, we got to ask all these questions before we get caught in that catch-22. Right.
And I would be very surprised if an insurance company would allow a non-active employee to pay into the policy when they're not working for the county, because we get stung every time a current employee has a major illness and it raises our rates. And so we have no control over what that person does who's no longer working in the county. They could be doing anything else but paying their insurance through us. I don't think that's allowed. I've never heard of that, but that's the issue for me, right?
So I guess in these scenarios, the employee is retiring. He's retiring from Bertie County. And I'm going to assume they're retiring from Bertie County, they're going to retire from the retirement system. They're going to pull their pension benefit. Mm-hmm. So at that point, they would move into our retirement group.
But I'm not talking about their pension benefit. I'm talking about that health insurance cost to the county, because we are covered under what that premium pays. So if that person got extremely ill during that period, we would have to eat that additional cost as part of our fee.
And that would concern me. To his point also, getting that money up front doesn't mean that's what our insurance premium is going to be next year.
That is correct.
It could go up $400 extra per month. Yes. Okay. And that's the whole thing here.
What do you figure on an average? I know it's different for different people. On average, what do we figure the health cost of us?
So pre-65 is the number that we're going to be looking at as the biggest game player here, because COBRA is like benefit continuation from our group plan. So that's just going to be the same price.
Yeah.
According to our discussion with finance, that average cost right now is $1,400. And some plans vary a little differently because they actually have to fill out an application and submit information about their health.
Personal health.
Yeah, for each individual retiree does. So each plan could cost a little bit different. So yeah, and that's why it's kind of rough average estimate of $1,400 because it's
not. And it goes back down to are they smokers?
Sure.
Do they have a heart condition? Do they have a kidney ailment? Something of this nature. That is information that I don't think we can even get our hands on because of exactly HIPAA, and they go straight to the insurance company, and then they turn around and make a decision what they're going to do. Well, you find out the information. If nobody has any more questions or statements on this, then you got your hands full.
It's complicated.
It's very complicated. I just don't want us to get bit down the line because we did not ask the right question, and their response is, you never ask us. If you'd ask us, we told you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good. Great work. Great work, Courtney. Great work.
Thank you. Okay. The next on our agenda is going to be an update of ownership of water lines in Scotch Hall Preserve by Attorney Jonathan Huddleston. Huddleston, you're on board.
Yes, just getting my microphone situated. This is on the agenda at today's work session because a little while back, the topic of the Scotch Hall water system came up at a previous work session where we discussed maintenance of the system and whose responsibility it is. Juan and I and Ricky have been communicating about it off and on over the last several months. I've been trying to gather all the facts that I could gather so I could bring those back to you and you guys could be advised and then decide where to go. So I'll give you a brief history. In 2005, Innsbruck, called Innsbruck at the time, they were developing the subdivision, wanted to put in a water system. They came to the county because they know the county had water districts. We've had water districts since way back past 2005. So they came to the county, discussed what's the process. They made a proposal, the county talked about it. In any event, the county had some checklists, what they call checklists, for what they do when a private developer needs a line. And scenarios like a water main, in this case from Highway 17 to the gate at Innsbruck. There's a checklist for how you go through that, from how the process starts to who pays for what, and who tested at the end, and how you go through the process. And then there's a separate checklist for if a developer wants to put in their own system inside their gates. And there's actually two different checklists. One where the developer takes care of everything. They perform all services. And then there's another one where the county would perform the services. So the process began. The county commissioners in November of 2005 updated their checklists. And it had things like, this is for like a privately financed waterline extension that's taken care of by the developer inside their gates. Ultimately, they would install the system in communication and conjunction with, in communicating with the county and the county's engineer. They would test the system, test results, get a final inspection. They would have an engineer certify in writing that the project was complete, convey the easements to the water district, and then give the water district the as-built plans, the plans that show what's there in the end.
And where it's at, the pipes.
Go ahead. Where the pipes are at, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that way, if the county's going to maintain the system, they know where the pipes are. It's a pretty important thing. Foreshadowing there, because that didn't exactly happen. All right, so Hobbs Up Church, the Innsbruck hired Hobbs Up Church as their engineers. Hobbs Up Church designed the system. Innsbruck put it in. For right now, I'm not talking about the extension from Highway 17 to the gate. Right now, I'm just talking about
inside the subdivision.
Yeah, exactly. Sometime during the construction, a dispute arose between Innsbruck and their general contractor. In the process of that, of the dispute, the Hobbs Up Church ended up leaving the job. I'm not sure if they left the job or were asked to leave the job, but anyway, they were no longer on the job. The contractor finished the system with another engineer. And the system was completed, but a number of the last checks on the checklist were not completed. I don't have all the detail yet on exactly which ones were not completed, but I can, so for instance, I don't know if there was what kind of testing was done, pressure testing or disinfection testing.
And you're talking about the current or the engineering firm that took over after Upchurch, correct?
Yeah. Whose name right now, I'm not even sure
okay.
what their name is.
My question is that while we're on that subject right there,
yeah.
Was there a timeline? Was there a timeline that they had to do this by? That's a key question here. Okay.
Okay.
And we need to know that.
Okay. So it's up there with between the general contractor and that new contractor. I mean, there'd be a contract there.
Of course.
That would probably have a deadline.
Absolutely.
And it would have their own deadline or timeline. Are you asking about that deadline? Or
I'm asking about that deadline. I'm asking about the next deadline with the next contractor.
Right.
And was there a contract or any type of written agreement between Bertie County and, we're going to call it Innsbrook, okay?
Right.
That stated, and was there a time frame there that this was all supposed to happen by, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So I don't know what those deadlines are right now.
Those time frames.
Time frames, right.
And what was the deadline dates?
Right.
If there were any.
I'll
I wouldn't imagine our attorneys would let us walk into an open-ended contract, though.
Right. I mean, the contract, we were not a party to the contract between the general contractor and...
That part I understand. But if they're trying to somehow... If somebody's saying that we have a responsibility to maintain their water lines in there, there would have to be some sort of written agreement between the county and them, correct?
Well, there would need to be, at the end of the checklist, they would turn the system over to the county.
Okay, but there's got to be particular verbiage in there mm-hmm. of a time frame that they're doing this.
Well, you probably, there's not a contract between the county and Innsbrook, but there's a set of checklists they have to follow, and I guess the time frames would be in there, wouldn't they?
I don't know. I've never seen it.
Okay.
And if you need to look it up later on and get back with us, that's fine. But I think those are key ingredients to this whole deal.
So the checklist they had to follow was a checklist that the county required.
Yeah.
For the water system inside of Innsbrook.
Correct. And there, I don't see any time frames in the checklist.
Yeah. But what does that, if that's with what they do within Innsbrook, if the county had any responsibility, there would have to be a separate agreement around that, wouldn't it?
That's what I'm saying. And I'm sure our attorneys would make sure they had a time frame to meet this for us to do whatever. Yeah. Does that make sense, John?
Yes.
Is that checklist just an inspections thing, or is it a list of conditions under which we would take over the system?
Because you did make that comment of taking over the system.
That's the question.
And not trying to throw too much on you at one time while you're flipping pages.
Right.
But if there is no as-builts, okay, designating where piping systems are at, things of that nature, then wouldn't that make it impossible for us to take something over by not knowing where the location of the pipes are at?
Yeah.
Or what roads are crossing and things of that nature? Because they are doing horizontal boring underneath roads to run 6-inch lines to get them down, the water going to where it needs to be. And I'm talking about on subdivision property, correct?
Right.
And it's privately owned. Correct?
Right.
So my thought process is if we don't have any of this stuff, then how can we even have an agreement with them?
Right. Okay. Well, to that point, the Scotch Hall for 15 years, Innsbrook and now Scotch Hall has been the one maintaining the lines. Talking to Ricky, talking to Steve Biggs, talking to John Ed Whitehurst, those that were around then and are still able to answer, you know, to talk about what they recall.
So basically we don't have an agreement to take it over then. Is that correct or not?
I don't believe we have an agreement to take it over.
Because
even if you deem the checklist as being a prelude to the county taking it over and be responsible, the checklist items have not all been met.
Exactly. And there's not a particular agreement. Now to Commissioner Atkins, I think it was January 20, some around that area when you came up with the question as far as Scotch Hall and the water system in there, who is responsible for that?
Right. The fire hydrants to
everybody. That's going to be a part of the water system.
What rate
exactly. But all that's going to be tied together. You're exactly right, Commissioner Atkins.
Yeah.
There's nothing that states anything like this. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. I don't, and looking at our file and talking to everybody, I don't know of any separate agreement where the county signs saying we're, other than the checklist that they have to meet,
right,
where the county would end up having responsibility.
So getting back to Commissioner Atkins' question, which was about 6 months ago, I guess, okay, the fire hydrants that are inside that subdivision would not be the responsibility of the county. Would that be correct? Because I think that was the matrix to your question, correct?
That's what brought this subject to our attention. Somebody
a fire chief was
exactly
having problems with maintaining these hydrants.
Well, and we had a side discussion about whether you're even supposed to use hydrants for fire suppression anyway. They're more for flushing the system and testing.
Well, I think they're also for filling the tanks.
For refilling, yeah. I mean, yeah. Refilling tanks, yeah, but not.
But yeah, you do use them under negative pressure. But exactly. No, you're exactly right. But wouldn't that also go back to the same suit? They had their own engineers that designed that system, correct?
Right.
Our engineers did not design that system. So in reality, we don't know what those fire hydrants are capable of doing, correct?
Yeah, but let me ask, I want to be clear on one other thing you said, and I didn't hear you really answer that. The checklist, was that simply a requirement of the county for Innsbruck as, as we do with anybody, like inspection kind of thing, or was that a checklist that if they met those agreements, would turn it over to the county?
And that was the agreement I'm looking
that,
for.
What was is that agreement? Is, you know, there's a difference, right? So which kind of agreement is that? An agreement in terms of what they were required to do by the county for their own maintenance of it or operation of it, or after they completed it, is that what turned it over to the county?
Just to refresh your memory again, one of the issues seemed to be that the county was reading water meters at the homes.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to say that. So you throw into it, the county's reading water meters at the homes and billing for the water that those users use.
But that's because we didn't have a master meter.
That we don't have a master meter.
That's why we're reading them at home. It's the only way to do it.
Well, there is a master meter at the gate.
But it was never worked.
It has not
been. It's never turned up.
But there is one at the gate.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's never used.
Right.
All right. If I remember correctly, and I'm going back in time, okay, and this is before Commissioner Atkins and Mr. Robertson was on the board. If I'm not mistaken, they came to us and asked for a service, okay? Was that part of the service they asked for? Do you remember, Commissioner Wesson?
No, I don't, John, not specifically. I mean, I know they came to us, but I'm not sure whether or not they wanted us to read it from a master meter or... Because at that time, we were reading it from the individual meters.
Absolutely. And again, I don't know what their... it's been 7 years ago, maybe eight, okay?
And the reason for that was because a previous county manager said to us, well, if we're only reading the water meters at the residences, how do we know they aren't using much more water to water their golf course?
That's
which they were. And that was not coming through a meter. That was coming through the master,
and that's
not the individual
master
home
meters. What should have been read or corresponding back. So anyhow.
And they do. There are meters, speaking to the meters inside the gate, there are meters at the houses, and there are meters at the shed, you know, where they have the restaurant, at the pool,
right,
at the clubhouse.
Right.
There's like four different, Ricky told me there's like four different other meters that are reading from four specific locations. But there's still, obviously, there still is that question that if there was a break in a line on hole number three,
that's right,
then the only way that would be caught is you compare your master meter reading to add, and then you add up all your interior readings right. And see if they match.
Absolutely.
And all of those places were not in existence at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, right. To Commissioner Wesson's question, okay, he's brought up the subject that we have meters at every house out there, okay. Did we charge them for these meters at each house? Did the homeowners charge for those meters at these houses? Okay, so they paid what, $1,100, $1,500, whatever it is for a meter at their house?
It was $50 during that time, I believe.
I'm not sure what the rates are. So your question was, did they pay for the meters?
Did they have to buy the meters from us? And was there an agreement? Well, this is something that would have to go back in time again.
Yeah.
And was there some sort of agreement?
The whole thing is that the county ever have any agreement directly
that's
with Scotch Hall right Innsbruck there. About doing anything?
Well, exactly.
Because that's exactly. The whole question. If we didn't, we're good.
Exactly.
But if we did, that's it could be a problem.
Right.
Well, the checklist, well, the best I can do right now is tell you what the first paragraph of the checklist says. So mm-hmm. It at least will identify what it is. Mm-hmm. Whether it's an inspection list or whether it's somehow
obligated
to an agreement.
Right.
Read that.
Checklist C for privately financed water line extensions of Berkeley County Water Districts 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the water districts are hereinafter referred to as BCRWS. Within a subdivision with developer performing services. So this is chopped up. This is the checklist where it's privately financed. It's an extension into a subdivision, and the developer is the one that's actually performing the services inside the subdivision. It says checklist C is an option for a developer who wishes to use developer selected technical, engineering, legal, construction, and administrative services in a licensed utilities contractor. BCRWS's engineer shall review all final plans and specifications prepared by the developer's engineer before BCRWS approves permit requests at the beginning of construction. The developer's engineer is required to provide full-time resident inspection, and the developer must pay for BCRWS's engineer to inspect the installation, construction, and completion of the proposed waterline extensions within a subdivision. All construction costs shall be at the expense of the developer. Upon completion of the facilities, the developer shall be responsible for conveying all completed and necessary improvements, facilities, rights of ways, and easements to BCRWS. BCRWS's attorney shall verify proper conveyance of the improvements, facilities, rights of ways, easements to the appropriate water district.
Okay, so they just said in that statement there that once they do this, all this comes over to Bertie County Water System.
That's what it says.
That's exactly what that just said.
Right.
So my only argument would be if they did not complete those things. But right. If they did, it's on us.
Exactly.
Right. And
well, as my understanding, we were never given a map of where these.
There's nothing like that. We have nothing that tells us where water lines are crossing at, where they're going on the roads and things of that nature.
Towards the end of the checklist, it's developer provides laboratory bacteriological water tests. Let me see. Developer schedule a final inspection with everybody. Developer's engineer shall certify in writing to BCRWS that the project is complete and satisfactorily complies with all applicable federal, state, and local regulations.
Have we ever gotten that?
I don't know that that's ever been done, to my knowledge.
Same here.
I don't have anything in my file indicates that, but I don't know if there's anything in the county files.
You can check, but
we can get with Ricky, and we need to check that to see if that is a factor.
And then they're supposed to convey it right of ways to the county. And if they had done that,
True. There would have to be something in writing where you guys had done the conveyment.
Get
the easement.
We would have prepared the right of way or easements. Let's just call them easements. I don't see any indication in our file that one was conveyed. And I think probably the reason for it is probably because we never got any as-built and really didn't have anything, a set of plans to refer to where these easements should be. I think it relates back to the as-built.
Okay. Here's the $10 million question. Since we haven't gotten the easements, okay, you haven't filed for easements because they haven't given you anything. You don't have as-built, so you can do that, correct?
Right.
Okay. There's been no communication for us to take over easements or anything of that nature, correct?
Right.
And how many years have gone by? What are we, 16 years into this thing? I would have to say that it'd be some sort of limitations as far as what their claim could be or if there would be one for us to take it over. Does that make sense, what I just said?
Right.
They haven't asked us to take
no.
That the question that no. Greg raised about this was, so what if our house burns down on that property? And who is responsible for making sure that those water hydrants had the right pressure to be able to service or not? Nothing about them asking us to take over anything.
No.
That was the question he asked about. Who would be at fault?
This is how it came. But the fire chief came to me and said, look, you know, somebody's house is going to. It could very well burn down because these hydrants aren't working. And whose hydrants are they?
Yeah, but again, if it has not been conveyed to the county.
Well, right now, it's Scotch Hall's fire.
Exactly. If it has not been conveyed to county, we have not been given easements in writing, okay, which we haven't, all right? And we haven't had any of the certification papers supposedly their engineers have done. That'd be something you guys would need to check on. Then I would say it's their deal. Would that not be you as an attorney? I mean, what you would be thinking? Where's our easements? Where's our as-built, all these things that never ever happened.
Right. With what I've got in front of me right now, that's my conclusion.
Does the fact that these water meter readings, water meters at the homes change anything?
Right. Right. Well, I mean, my thought on that is that we're responsible for the.
We own the water. We don't own the system, is what he's getting ready to say.
Say that again.
We own the water. We don't own the system.
Yeah, we provide water to these specific locations. They pay us for it. So you could say our responsibility ends at that point. We're providing a service, and they pay for that service. Now, yes, sir.
How do we confirm that they never completed the check? Or we don't see an improvement. Because if they completed the checklist, if they say, if their claim is they did, and they have proof that they completed the checklist, that what you just read says it converts to us. That we say on what kind of terms it converts to us.
Right.
If they completed the checklist.
Right.
So it all hinges on,
right,
did they do that or not?
I think you're right. I think it very much hinges on that. And I've I got to prove something doesn't exist. I don't know how. I'm not exactly sure how.
Check your files and find out what it'd be.
They would have to show.
Well, they would be the burden on them.
Exactly.
To provide that.
No. Exactly. Right. This conversation has come up once before years ago.
Yeah, I think it would be.
Okay. Ron? Commissioner Wesson, this conversation came up 7 years ago, and the conclusion was we owned the water, but we didn't own the system. That was the conclusion at that time.
Right.
But I never remember, John, anything about any kind of checklist or anything like that.
I didn't know anything about any of that either.
I never heard that before until now.
Exactly.
We just assumed, because we were never aware, because we never did any service on the phone other than read the meters. And we assumed that since we didn't do it, it must not have been our creek or our responsibility.
Well, the reason I came across a checklist was because Innsbruck had made a proposal that here's how we suggest to do it. And the county commissioners looked at it and said, well, no, we've got some checklists in place. As a matter of fact, we want to update our checklists. And so I have an email to Misty Deans, and I don't have a copy of the signed resolution or the signed checklist. So there's a little more, looking to me to make actually sure, but I it's hard to remember 15 years back, but I've got an email to Misty Deans, who is the assistant county manager at the time, saying, hey, the commissioner, here's an unsigned set of copies of the resolution county commissioners passed today. And that was November 7, 2005. So I'm pretty sure this resolution that updated these checklists was actually put in place. And the resolution reads, just in brief, it says there's four county water districts. Each one has its own set has adopted a uniform rules and regulations governing the operation. It says when they adopted them, one was 93, one was 97, one was 93, one was 98. Each district has determined through its governing board that a new policy should be adopted governing the privately financed water distribution line extensions to areas not previously served by Central Water to make it absolutely clear how privately financed water distribution line extensions may be approved and installed. And so then it says, to accomplish this clarification, Section 7, entitled Extensions to Mains and Services, in each of the rules of each water district must be amended. And then now, therefore, it says we're amending it. And then one of the little subparagraphs said, upon completion of any extension, the developer will convey any interest it may have in the completed facility, including all rights of ways, to the county water district. And I can't find anything in my file that shows that they finished that process and that they.
And nothing in your file that said, you haven't seen anything in your file saying that we have accepted conveyment of this.
No, like for instance, I do closings at Scotch Hall, and we do title searches, and I just verify with my staff. Every time we do a title search, we always put on the search results, any easements, any, first of all, any, restrictive covenants, plenty of those out there, right? Amendment after amendment after amendment. We put all this on there. It's a long list. And I know there's a communications easement. And I could not ever remember specifically seeing a water district easement. So I just spoke with my staff, and they don't ever remember seeing, a water district easement either.
Well, let me ask another question real quick, and this may be for county manager and assistant county manager. If in fact we don't own that system, but we own the water, okay? They own the system to transport it, the water, okay? Right. Would that not be personal business property tax in itself, a part of the appraisal of that property, and it would go into personal business property tax, water lines that they own? Because I know it is with gas lines. I know it is with cable that runs underground. And if it's not,
well, it should be either in the real estate or personal property, one of the two.
I'd say personal property because it's separate from the dirt. It's something that's put in by man.
So, Mr. Vaughn, if a line ruptured within on the other side of Maine, and that line is sitting there flowing water, and that water is not being metered, they have really no incentive, unless it's flooding their whole place, to fix the line because it's not being
metered. And that's the reason the master meter needs to be read.
Thank you, right.
And that was the reason that the county manager said we're not currently reading the master meter. We're reading those individuals. So how do we know that they aren't separate access to water the golf course?
And
if
there's
no meter, then we could find that water.
We went out there. We drove out there. We drove out there. My question to you is this. Is there, in fact, a master meter out there? And the reason you're positive about that.
I'm saying yes. According to Ricky, yes, he confirmed that.
Uh-huh. Okay, but it has never been used.
Correct.
So it's showing zero.
So that's probably 20 years old.
I assume we can, and Ricky may be on the call, but I can't confirm the date.
No, I get it. But yes, something you got to research.
Okay. I would think we would almost have
to calibrate it again.
Because as I said, a line corruptor. And they could say, I'm not saying they would, but they could say, I want it fixed. Y'all come fix it. If you don't, we'll just let it sit in and run into the pond.
Now, Ricky
now this guy right over sends them a letter and says, we don't know it.
We could cut off the water meter. They have to fix it.
Exactly.
We do have some leeway.
Well, I don't know if you could legally cut water off to a subdivision. I think that's illegal.
Cut off people's water.
They don't pay the bill.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But could you cut it off to all those individuals?
Yeah, but if you've got individuals that are paying their bill, you can't just shut off the master meter to them. I mean, that's all there is to it.
Ricky did say that there was a water line issue down there not too long ago, and the maintenance crew at Scotch Hall went out and fixed it. The guys that are out there
Well, that would be prima facie right there, evidence years. Within itself that they think they own that system.
Right.
That's it. That's prima facie. I mean, that.
Right.
Would that not be correct?
Right.
Okay. I think it's pretty much settled who owns that system.
I think we need a meter at the.
Well, I think the master meter up front needs to start being read. And why it hasn't been for how many years? 2005 till now? What's that, 16 years? That's
and maybe this is a question for you, Jonathan. I don't know. Do we need to continue? I mean, the system seems to be working okay. Do we need to continue reading meters at the house, or is that a bad idea?
That's a good question.
Well, if we sold them the meters, we have an obligation to read that meter. But we also have an obligation to be reading that master meter and doing a comparison to make sure that we're not getting nailed.
Yeah, because if they're not meters at the end of the residence, having a statement even from them saying that they own that system. But to Greg's point, I can think about that. You know, I can argue with them, but if a homeowner's house burns down and you can't, there's not enough pressure that those fires in order to service that.
Well,
sue Scotch Hall, they could very easily sue the county if they thought that it was our responsibility. If that belongs to Scotch Hall, they say yes, they belong to us.
To your point of what you just said, Commissioner Wesson, I thought we had discussed a letter to be sent to Scotch Hall stating that the fire hydrants out there at this subdivision are your responsibility as long and all of the water lines are your responsibility. In other words, not asking them, do they belong to us or not? You're making a statement to them just so that you're the new owners of, because it has changed hands. Now, of course, back then, I don't think it changed hands 6 months ago, but maybe it had when we had our meeting in January. But send a letter, and again, this has got to be board that would want this, and our attorneys to say, yeah. But send a letter stating to the new owners, we are making you aware that the water lines in Scotch Hall and fire hydrants are the responsibility of Scotch Hall. In other words, we're not asking them who's responsible. We're making a statement who's responsible.
Yeah, you're right. That was discussed. And the only reason that letter hadn't been sent is because we had to look back through 15 years of records to see if there was an agreement. Juan and I talked about it, and my thought was, well, I wanted to see, just like you guys were asking, is there an agreement already out there?
But right now you can't find it.
I've spent months researching, okay, and I have not found any agreement.
Well, now's the time.
All I found is these old. These
now's things. The time to do the letter, correct?
Right. Yeah.
Tell them that. Doesn't make sense to say it is our understanding that this is the case. If you have evidence to the contrary, provide it.
Well, I think if we sent them a letter that was direct, it said, hey, these lines and the fire hydrants are the responsibility of the subdivision or subdivision owners, and however else letter you want to put in that. And if they say, well, no, they're not, they're going to send you a letter back anyhow. I would rather just tell them that they own it, and that's it, because everything you show says they do own it.
If you told me I own something and I knew I didn't, I got to tell you nothing. If they
happen, well, guess what? We've got the letter stating that we've already made our position on that. And they have a responsibility to respond.
But it just seems more logical. These are partners. These are good folks we've dealt with. Say, this is our, you have any information to the contrary, you need to tell us. But we're clearly believing that you won't.
And again, to your point again, and not debating, we have no as-bills. If they said no, they belong to you, what do we do with it then?
No, we just have to show us documentation that it does. Our assumption that we've done that they belong to you. If you believe that is not the case, then you're required to show us some proof that you do not.
We're both on the same thing. We definitely need to get them a letter and get us out of the liability position here.
And it may should include that it's come to our attention that there's a number of hydrants that aren't functioning properly. Just so they,
I agree. All right, does anybody get any more questions on this? We can just move on forward now. Everybody good? Okay. Next thing is going to be discussion of metal detecting on county property.
At the last meeting, commissioners, you're aware we had a request that the citizen expressed that request to the board verbally, where he wanted to be able to metal detect on county properties. And during the last meeting, we discussed identifying, number one, the properties. If you all would like to allow anyone in the public to metal detect our properties. So I think we should or need to discuss identifying the areas or properties that the public can metal detect if it's something that we want to do, and then putting measures or rules in place to pretty much dictate or, you know, put some requirements or stipulations on exactly what can be done. And Commissioner Atkins had a question during that last meeting, and I believe that question was, unless we explicitly say, no, you can't, do citizens have the right or authority to do it? And I was speaking with Attorney Holton about that.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I can speak to that question and give you some of the parameters that you might consider in whether to allow metal detecting and where. Did some research. And first of all, the county property is the county has just as much right as any private property owner to restrict the public's access. Right. At different locations, times, and days. Good example is this building we're sitting in here right now. It opens at a certain time and it closes at a certain time. So we're restricting access to the public, even though it's technically a public building. Reasonable restrictions that are not discriminatory. They're not somehow illegal. So so that's just an obvious example. As far as metal detecting goes, a couple things to consider is, let me kind of go off that thought. Metal detecting involves a little more than walking on county property. It involves a little more than throwing a ball, kicking a ball, exercising, playing a game. It involves digging a hole. It involves finding things with a detector, digging a hole, and then taking something from that hole. And if that something seems to be of value, removing it from county property. So it is something, clearly the county has the right, to restrict or put some rules on. State, somebody pointed this out last meeting, the state does not allow any metal detecting in any of its parks, with the one exception being that if you've lost an item of personal property, you can get a special use permit to go back and find it. The federal properties, there are a couple of federal laws that are in place, antiquities laws, archaeological laws, that basically prohibit anybody from removing anything from the ground at a certain age. But counties, just if, in my research, generally speaking, I looked at Dare County, for instance. You see a lot of metal detecting on the beach. And there's actually some metal detecting societies, and they got websites. And it was, I just was checking the law and sort of how the different societies are advising their members. And there are definitely places that are county property, that are beach property, that are allowed. But then you get south of Nag's Head, you get into Pea Island Refuge, can't do any metal detecting there because you get on state or federal property. So it varies. And so metal detectors are told, do your due diligence, talk to the local authorities if you're thinking about metal detecting somewhere, which is what this fella has done, which is the right thing to do. So it's up to the county to decide how they want to handle it. I guess the specific answer to your question, Mr. Atkins, they certainly have the right to go. Let's just take the park, for instance, the recreation park. I mean, they have the right to go out there. Do they have the right to metal detect? I think they have the right to be out there. I mean, I don't think there's no rule in place right now that prevents someone from going out there with a metal detector and detecting. Now, do they have the right to dig a giant hole with a backhoe? I mean, you can go ahead and jump to the extreme. Maybe not. And that's why it wouldn't be a bad idea for the county, if you're considering allowing it, to have some rules. So basic rules might be things like, restricted as to, first of all, property. So for instance, do you want someone detecting and digging at Tall Glass of Water, where there's archaeological artifacts? Maybe not. Maybe that should be totally off limits. That, of course, will be your decision. Other property, like just say, one place that probably would be popular would be the recreation park, because people there might want to look for jewelry or coins or things of that nature. And so you could just place whatever non-discriminatory restrictions you please on that. Possibly the size of the hole, the depth of the hole. One of the main things is just be sure you fill your hole. If you're, because kids that are playing soccer on the soccer field or baseball on the baseball field don't need to be tripping over holes. Maybe you don't even allow someone to metal detect on the actual fields of play, only between the fields of play. Utilities, things that are, there's little things about metal detecting you got to think about. You don't know what's underneath the surface. So you got to be careful about somebody jamming a large shovel in the ground. Maybe you only let them use hand trowels. And that way, you're not likely to cut.
And then it comes back, we're liable because they've hit a power line that is under the ground by 18 inches or whatever it may be. And
right.
Whatever.
Right. Right. So
that's something that's tremendous value on county property.
Right.
That belongs to them. On a coin that could be worth millions. And that's
right. Right. So addressing that, it might be that anything they find of value has to be turned into the county, or has to be at least reviewed by the county. Then you get into a question of what is of value. If you find a 500-year-old coin, it's an old piece of metal to one person, but it might be something of great value to somebody else. So I'm just saying it is allowable. Well, it's not allowable on state and federal parks. It can be allowable on county property, town property. But most towns and counties, when they allow it, like to put some reasonable restrictions on it, if they allow it.
Well, I think just me personally, and that I'm just speaking for myself, that we should follow the federal and state guidelines on something like that. I'll speak to the rest of my board members. Just for the simple fact, we don't know if anybody's going to find something and just walk off with it or give it to us. Or are they going to start filling in their holes that they dig? Or wood is going to be running under there that they may hit with a shovel. Because we didn't have a warning flag up, power line or water line, something of that nature. That's just me personally.
I think, Mr. Trent, I agree. I think maybe just more problems than it's worth. And I think also you have to consider, given the what I suspect would be the limited number of people interested in it, not worth making a whole lot of special provisions for a very limited number of county people here that would be interested.
I agree with that as well. I mean, county property is somewhat limited, so there's plenty of places to do that. Just cause more problems than it does.
We could, yeah.
I feel the same way the other commissions does, because number one, you know, we don't need any liability because somebody didn't fill the hole in and here come a child tripping and twisting the ankle while breaking their leg. So I feel the same way, you know.
So just to be clear, there's consensus among the board to not allow any metal detecting on county property.
Correct.
I'd even, if the board agrees with this, make it a little bit broader. No activities on county property unless it is authorized. Okay, right? Something of that nature. If somebody wants to go there and play soccer or something like that, and then just don't isolate it to metal detecting, but we can use some examples.
Examples out of Hurricane, many times where kids come out there with ATVs and tear up the
field. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. We end up having to pay for it.
Exactly. And we haven't stated that.
Yeah. No activities.
No activities outside of county.
Unless specifically authorized.
County ran activities unless specifically authorized. And the attorneys can throw something together. I know when I had whole harmless agreements put together, it gave examples and then it said, et cetera, to follow suit. Okay. And those were for indemnification and hold harmless agreements. And
I wonder what the state park policy looks like. That may be something we can look at and see if it would fit us.
Okay. There's no more discussion. We're going to move on.
Okay.
Next one's going to be discussion of rotation for chair and vice chair of the Board of Commissioners.
Yes, so commissioners, after, of course, we do it each December, the board selects the chair and vice chair. And after it was done, or shortly thereafter, we had a suggestion from Commissioner Atkins to take a look at a rotation system where, you know, it could alleviate a little bit of contention in our December meetings. And so our chair, LaShonda Cartwright, spoke with clerks in surrounding counties, and we couldn't find a surrounding county who has a rotation policy. Everyone selects that we've been able, that we've spoken to, just goes through that voting process during that first meeting in December. However, we can, of course, adopt our own if it's a pleasure before we can talk about, you know, a method that you all agree on if we want to develop a policy or a method of selecting the chair where it's by rotation.
There are a couple of exceptions. Sometimes it's by election policy in some counties like Mecklenburg. Mm-hmm. All of their commissions run at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So the person with the most votes is chairman.
Okay.
The second number of votes is vice chair.
Mm-hmm.
Because they all run at the same. That's just their policy. Let me say this. I mean, this is just a matter of the board votes. Here's an interesting thing that I was discussing with another person in another county, neighbor county. This is what they're considering. Done the same thing. They looked at this before. But their suggestion is that each year, when it comes up, commissioners who are interested in being chair put their name in the hat. They opt in. Right? So three people want interested in becoming chair, they put their name in,
the board votes until the person gets three votes. As opposed to having to be nominated, having to have it second, and all of that, or having to do a rotation. The problem with a rotation for me is that if someone was doing a great job and we wanted to keep them there, we should be able to vote to do that. If somebody who is on that rotation does not want to serve, they should have to serve. It's just easier. I mean, I know it's cumbersome to have to vote it in, but if you had a process that made it easier, like, okay, we've got five people on the board. How many people want to be considered? Sit up a chair. If one person raises their hand, okay. If two people raise, you take a vote. Three people raise. The person with three votes is in. Makes it simple for me.
Okay.
I'm whatever.
Yeah. And again, that's the way to do it. My thing is that Chairman Lee's not here.
Right. We should do anything.
We should do anything. No, okay. I'd just like to table this matter until she gets back. Okay. And then we can have another discussion well before December. Okay.
Coming.
I know. And shortly, absolutely. But if we can just table that matter till the next meeting, that would be great. Okay. All right. Is everybody good with that? Tabling this? Okay. Ron, you good?
I'm not, but I'll go on. I'll say okay. Because the reason I said that, John, Commissioner Trent, because I thought we had discussed that last time back in January, that, you know, but we'll wait till the Madam Chair get here. You're fine.
Okay.
Mr. Trent, let me say, I have got to leave at 1 o'clock. So if there's anything that you really need me here for, that I think we're going to get out of here by then.
I don't think there's anything at this stage. I mean, you can roll.
I'm good right now, but I'm going to have to leave.
Well,
that in case of something that we need to do.
We got one item left. And again, I know this meeting's run over, but there were several things, two or three things here that had to have severe discussion on. Sure. And a couple of these things were things that you had brought up in the past that we needed to really iron these things out. So other items as needed. Upcoming events, community redistricting workshop, drawing the line, Hertford, Bertie, Martin, Beaufort County, October 6th, 6 p.m. via Zoom, regional economic summit on October 14th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Elizabeth City, Mayors and Commissioners Dinner on the 14th, 7 p.m. at the Colerain Fire Department. And these are really just updates, okay, yes, as far as what's coming up in the near future. And since we have just covered that, you've got it in writing. Is there any discussion y'all want on this? If not, then I will take a motion to adjourn. Go ahead.
I have asked to bring to the board from the town of Windsor, my district, because we have a meeting today. They are going forward with the property that we gave them for the fire training center.
Okay.
They wanted to let us know that, make them aware that they are now drawing plans to build that center. And they're going to come back to us with a date, probably in November, for us to have a groundbreaking and they wanted to make us aware of this. The main thing is to let us know that they have at least secured the funds to do it in November. And there's been 5 years. They've got commitments from surrounding counties to use it.
Okay, is that all? Okay, can I have a motion?
I move.
You got a first? Have a second? You got a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you, gentlemen.